You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week, National Party MP and mental health spokesperson Matt Ducey said the government should pause its rollout of the Access and Choice program after a quarterly stocktake of the program released by the Ministry of Health showed it was lagging behind in some metrics. The data that came out showed that over the March 2022 quarter, each full-time equivalent mental health worker had conducted on average just one session per day. Matt Ducey called this a red flag. Has the data, in your view, been interpreted correctly by the National Party?
No, it's a very crude assessment. He's just taken some figures and divided by others. What he doesn't take account of is non-working days, and in that first quarter of this year, you know, the period from January to March, there are quite a few public holidays. It also doesn't take into account the fact that as new services get set up, you know, people aren't all starting on the 1st of January, and then they're not all starting with a full slate of people to see on those first days or weeks when they are commencing the service. It also doesn't take into account training days. So everybody who's appointed as a health improvement practitioner or a health coach has some training that's provided before they sort of get fully stuck into it. So he's just made a whole heap of assumptions that aren't borne out. And really, you know, when he says it should be paused, that's completely in contradiction to what he was saying last year, which is what it needs to be sped up. Actually, we just need to continue the rollout. We are meeting a lot of the targets, particularly in terms of coverage of the enrolled patient population, which is, you know, what we measure it by, because there is a need, and wherever we are rolling it out, we are meeting a need.
Is there a target number of sessions per day set out by the government that each full-time equivalent mental health worker should be hitting?
Not a particular sort of number of sessions per day. The real question is, are we getting adequate coverage of the, you know, population that we know could call on this type of service any time? So, and I like the health improvement practitioners that I've met who've been in the job for a while say there'll be days when they're doing eight sessions, there'll be days when they might be doing three or four sessions, but they are there. The whole idea is that they are there kind of and available at short notice, so that, you know, people aren't having to queue up and wait weeks and weeks to get an appointment. That's the whole thing of it. So you do build in some redundancy just so that there is that flexibility there and people can be available at short notice. That's the whole basis of the scheme.
If a program like this does have some issues that need addressing, is stopping and pausing it completely a good way to fix any issues that are there, or what is a good way, if there are any issues, to fix them?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, this is a big program, big complex program for a big, you know, complex issue that we're dealing with. But if there are problems, then you start, you know, you look at the problem and you deal with the problem. The reality is these services, these roles that are being, that people are being appointed to, are being rolled out and where they are very successful. And of course, they're not just in GP clinics, they're going into youth one-stop shops. They're going into Kaupapa Māori Health Services. They're going into Pacific Health Services. And each of them have a slightly different way of using the roles that have been created for each of those services. I know in the Pacific Health Services, they do a lot more group work. So they might do one session, but they might have, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 people there. It's the way, you know, they provide that kind of mild to moderate mental health support to many of the people in their community. So this, and the whole idea of the way we're rolling it out is to make sure the services are tailored to the particular needs of particular communities in this sort of way.
So co-governance has sort of been a big talking point this year. I thought I would start off by asking, what does the Treaty of Waitangi say about co-governance between Māori and the Crown?
Well, the treaty talks about tēnā rangatiratanga, and you know, for Māori or for iwi and hapū, is that their resources that they hold to in their whenua is they have tēnā rangatiratanga over it. So they have some control and decision making over it. Co-governance is the device in kind of 21st century language that is used to make sure that iwi and hapu have a real say on the natural resources in their rohe. So it is an important way to fulfil the Crown's obligations under Te Tiriti.
Some aspects implemented towards co-governance include three water legislation and the establishment of a Māori Health Authority. This is sort of the resource side and the health side. Is there any other areas of government that are being considered for sort of co-governance, such as maybe environment and conservation or justice system?
Certainly in the environment and conservation, I mean, through a lot of the treaty settlements now, certainly the ones that are being, I'm actively involved in at the moment, new ways of managing conservation needs are being kind of thought about and developed under sort of current treaty settlements. Likewise, in the environment space, as we go through the reforms of the Resource Management Act, the which is the principal piece of legislation for buildings and the way the environment is managed, making sure that iwi, particularly those iwi who have commitments under their treaty settlements, are being incorporated into that, means that there is, iwi are having a greater say on a whole lot of environmental decisions. And I might say too that the idea of co-governance goes back some time. Some of the early treaty settlements had iwi rights of decision making and joint decision making over certain discrete areas of land or certain kind of resources. So this is not new. I think it's been brought into sort of stark relief because there's more of it around and over significant things like the Waikato River and the Whanganui River. But that was the promise of the treaty. The treaty was very clear in the promise that it made that in order to establish government and nation state government, various rights of Māori would be preserved. That was completely trashed for many years, and we've been spent the last 40 years resurrecting what was promised in 1840. That's all we're doing.
There is a long way to go for Māori equality in New Zealand. How important do you feel Māori co-governance is to closing the gap on inequality?
It's essential, but it's essential for a lot of reasons to restore the Māori of many iwi and hapu and give them back, restore their whakapapa to their land and to those important definitive landmarks and resources that are part of who they are. So if we're going to restore the kind of social and economic foundation for Māori, we have to restore the Māori as well, and that's what co-governance helps to do.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
That was Tuva'a speaking to Labour's Andrew Little.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.